Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and, well, it's February, and the theme of February is the Going Red campaign for women, which is a campaign that I'm not entirely enamored with because it sounds to me like going red means checking up on a lot of women to see if their cholesterol is high so we can put more women on statin drugs. And that's decidedly not the theme of today's program. We're going to talk to an expert on women's health, a good colleague of mine. I've known her for many years, worked together with her. She's also a co-member with me of the American College for the Advancement of Medicine. In fact, she's been the program director for ACAM, which means that she knows a heck of a lot about some of the leading personalities within the field of complementary and alternative medicine. She's also developed curriculum for them. She has a private practice here in New York that we'll tell you more about. And she's an all-around expert on vitamins, nutrition, very much in line with my own personal philosophy. So without further ado, our guest today is Dr. Dana Cohen. It's a pleasure having you on board today with us, Dana.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Indeed, indeed. So, tell us a little bit about the Going Red for Women campaign. I presume that this is sort of a platform for you to talk about issues different than what the American Heart Association wants you to talk about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's a much needed campaign. So it has been started by the American Heart Association, but it's really about a campaign on trying to find. Are making women more, prevention, knowledgeable about prevention of heart disease. There were some recent studies that showed that including doctors were not giving, knowing the right signs and symptoms, and women weren't getting the same treatment as men with heart disease. And so this is a campaign just to really, it's geared towards people, women, as opposed to towards doctors. So there's a lot of good information. There's a lot of good stuff that they're doing, and I agree with.
Well, yeah, it's a consciousness-raising effort, and that's certainly, it's high time, because there really has been a lot of sexism and a real disparity in how medicine treats women when it comes to cardiovascular disease, because way back when in the Stone Age, when we were taught about heart disease, we were taught that it was primarily a disease of men. The women were far less susceptible, and we were told to recognize the classic symptoms of heart attack, which can actually manifest very differently in women. So how might that be? I mean, men clutch their chest; they might feel pain radiating down their arm; they break out in a sweat. And, of course, that may be applicable to women, but sometimes women have a different presentation, right?
Yeah. Well, so the number one symptom is still chest pain or discomfort. But with women, there's a few things that are a little bit different. Shortness of breath is one, and you can see it for a few weeks even before they have their heart attack. Irregular pain in their lower back or their upper back, jaw pain, nausea, vomiting. These are things that are a little bit different than you would typically see in men. Also sweating, lightheadedness. So these are things that more likely you'd see in women versus men, but just keep in mind the first thing is chest pain is still the number one cause. The other thing that I think it's important to say is that if you ask any woman what's the number one killer, most women don't know. It's heart disease. It's not cancer.
They might say breast cancer. I mean, because there's a tremendous dread of breast cancer. There's a lot of publicity around breast cancer, and it's a very defacing kind of disease. But then, the statistics really weigh far in favor of heart disease, right?
Yep, absolutely. Heart disease is the number one killer of women in this country. So this is very important that we make women more aware.
And so typically women are a little bit less prone to heart disease, but from what I understand, it occurs very frequently. It occurs later, but sometimes with even greater severity when it does hit women than in men.
Yeah, exactly. Meaning more likely death.
Yeah, exactly. And so... In the past, there have been many tragic episodes of doctors being dismissive of women's symptoms because they think, well, women complain a lot, they have aches and pains, they're a little hysterical, and that has led to misdiagnosis and tragedy.
and also less procedures, less life-saving procedures for women that could have been done because they didn't believe them or they didn't know that this was heart disease. So that's, we're trying to change all that.
Indeed. Okay, so but what's the information that we're not getting to women about heart disease prevention?
Is. Okay, so a couple things. Usual suspects, I just think we need to talk about them because they can't be talked about enough. Smoking. We need to quit smoking. I have to say, of everything I've ever done in my life, including medical school, there is nothing I am more proud of than my quitting smoking, you know, and it truthfully. And it's hard, but we have to, you know, I think we go through phases of talking about it with our patients. You know, I certainly know I kind of go in and out of it, and then I get on my bandwagon and I start talking about it again. But we need to not get off that bandwagon, and I still can't believe I see people smoking. So smoking, cholesterol, we can have a whole discussion about cholesterol, but there are nuances to cholesterol that I'm sure you're testing and I'm testing now that we can discuss, such as, you know, getting our good cholesterol higher, that HDL, and making that higher and making those particle sizes bigger and fluffier and affecting cholesterol in natural ways. So cholesterol is still a risk factor, and I don't think we're going to discuss how, you know, treatment for that right now, but that is one of the risk factors, and they need to talk to their preferably functional medicine doctors about it.
But there's clearly a lot of misunderstanding of the relationship between dietary cholesterol and the cholesterol that we find in our bloodstream. And recently, there's been sort of a relaxation on the constant drumbeat about lowering cholesterol intake. I mean, our dietary guidelines are still far from optimal, but there's been a little bit of revision and suggestion that maybe the dietary cholesterol is not the big factor that we once thought it was.
And thank goodness, you know, what we thought fats, what we had decided about fats, is no longer true. I mean, I think the biggest thing that I take now from fats, and I do measure fatty acids in patients, is trans fats. You know, we've gotten rid of them, and I have to say, when I check people's fats, I rarely see a high trans fats. I have mm-hmm. a trans fat level. I don't see it anymore. Do you?
Well, this is with the very extensive fatty acid profile that we do, that many, well, conventional doctors never do, but we actually measure the omega-3s, the omega-6s, the ratio between them, and exactly. That also gives us the trans fat levels, and we find, and by the way, you know, I don't know what type of patients you're seeing, but I'm not seeing the vast unwashed multitude from flyover country in middle America who are unaware of, you know, these advances in medicine and in nutrition.
Right.
I'm seeing very sophisticated patients who already have kind of cleaned up their act.
Exactly. So if we're talking about cholesterol in your diets, you're absolutely right. And now we're talking about healthier fats, eating healthier fats, and even some saturated fats is good and okay for you. So, yeah, that's exciting that they've pulled back on that. But there is still a lot of cholesterol testing that we can do, and we can manipulate naturally, you know, with diet and supplements and those kind of things.
Mm-hmm. So, and you're actually originally a disciple of Dr. Atkins, because you trained under the late Dr. Robert Atkins, and you saw the kind of work that he did with patients. He was a cardiologist. He worked with patients with cardiovascular disease and this was really very, very much heretical at that time, perish the thought, a low-carb, high-fat, high-protein diet. So how does that work to help certain patients?
So, I mean, I've seen it over and over. It low-carb, high-fat diets lower LDL cholesterol, improves HDL cholesterol, and lowers triglycerides. I see it time and time again. There was recently a study published out of Boston about the different diets affecting cholesterol. And the truth is, and whether you agree with me or not, if somebody's following a specific kind of diet plan, those numbers, those cholesterol parameters like LDL and HDL will improve if they're following what they're supposed to be doing and losing weight.
Regardless of the diet. So it could be like a vegan diet, or it could be a ketosis producing diet, you know, Atkins style, very low carb. It's still going to help, right?
If they follow it, it's all going to help cholesterol. Going back to those nuances of cholesterol, there was a study, I'm not sure it's quite published yet, by the same people that talked about this HDL particle. This is the thing I'm really interested in cholesterol now, is HDL particle sizes, and the bigger, the fluffier the HDL particle, the more improvement in cardiovascular risk. So on that same study of these diets, whether it's Mediterranean, low fat, low calorie, or Atkins, what they found is Atkins is the only one that increased the HDL particle size, thereby decreasing your cardiovascular risk a huge percentage, something like 23%. Yeah, really interesting.
Oh, good stuff.
So, yeah, yeah. So the cholesterol stuff is, like we said, I'm sure you have done many podcasts on on the cholesterol.
Sure.
Going back to sort of prevention talk for women, we talk about smoking, cholesterol, blood pressure. There's still many people who just don't see doctors and don't get their blood pressure checked. It is a risk factor, and we need to know what your blood pressure is. The biggest thing is blood sugar. There is now all this advanced metabolic testing, cardiometabolic testing you can do to look at blood sugar. Things like, more than even hemoglobin A1C, which is the marker of what your blood sugar does over the course of a 3-month period. And maybe even easier than doing a glucose tolerance test, which I know you and I have been doing for years, glucose and insulin tolerance test, which is a little bit of a pain because it's long, but a really good test. So knowing blood sugar, pre-diabetes markers, those kind of things are really important, and history of that, family history. The weight and diet stuff are all prevention stuff that we can talk about with women. But the biggest thing and the biggest connection that I want to talk about today that's really exciting for me is putting together cardiovascular health and bone health, and specifically in women. Mm-hmm. I know you and I have talked about this many years ago when I worked for you. And
full disclosure, yes, indeed. And a very, very capable associate you were.
Thank you.
Sad to see you go, but you had to strike out on your own, and you're very successful in your own right.
And to this day, one of my greatest mentors and first person I call when I have a question is you. We were talking about calcium. For years we were talking about, not sure if we should be giving women calcium alone. And, us integrative docs have been talking about this for a long time. And meanwhile, people keep saying, especially like the milk people, need more calcium.
The Tums people. Remember the Tums era? It was like, chew up Tums all day long and you'll have strong bones. But where does that excess calcium go?
Into your arteries.
Uh-oh.
And, uh-oh, exactly. So there has been some very recent studies about high, supplementing calcium increases your risk of cardiovascular disease and death from all causes, and cardiovascular disease. And there's a real paradox here, because there's also been many studies that say we need calcium for bone strength and for bone health. It's important for us that we need to protect our bone and prevent osteoporosis.
And for women, especially.
Especially for women, yes. And so what's this missing link? And what we have recently found out, and I will tell you right now, mark my words, vitamin K, and specifically vitamin K2, is going to be like the new vitamin D. You're going to start to hear everybody talking about vitamin K within the next couple of years, because I think it's that important. So vitamin K, we need vitamin K in order to take calcium out of our arteries and put it into our bones, basically.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes referred to it as the crossing guard for calcium. You know, you can take all the calcium you want, but it may go to the wrong places without vitamin K to essentially tell it where to go. So now, the question would be, you know, I can understand maybe why there's a lot of vitamin D deficiency. It's partly because, you know, people don't spend a lot of time in the sun anymore. They live in northern latitudes. But why should there be a vitamin K deficiency? Are there certain foods that are rich in vitamin K that we're not getting, or is it the effect of too many antibiotics, or we're disrupting our microbiome? What's happening?
Yeah, good, really good question. So, about 97% of our Western population is deficient in vitamin K. It's mostly found in fermented foods and things like soft cheeses, yogurts.
Stinky cheese,
but some hard cheese, Gouda also, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, Gouda is a good
I remember my dad used to love these. You know, he's European. He loved this, is what we called the stinky cheese, and we would always kind of like recoil at the table when he was, spreading it on his bread. But those are rich in vitamin K. But also, you say the hard cheeses. But there's also a stinky substance from Japan called natto, which Westerners don't really care too much for.
Yeah, have you ever tried it?
I have indeed, yeah. I developed a taste for it because I was macrobiotic for many years, so we kind of got into it.
So natto is these, like, fermented beans. Are they soybeans?
Soy,
mm-hmm. Actually, soybeans, yeah, fermented soybeans, these sticky fermented soybeans. I have not yet developed a taste for it. It's definitely, you know, it's something different. I liken it to what's the Australian stuff that they eat all the time?
Marmite.
That yeasty thing.
Marmite.
I don't know how they eat
that. That's an Israeli thing, too, by the way. I learned to eat that on the kibbutz because that was a big popular thing on the kibbutz. I was on an English kibbutz with a lot of English Jews who'd migrated to Israel. So they love their Marmite, which is, you know,
Vegemite,
which is basically pure yeast extract.
Oh, that stuff. I mean, the smell of that stuff. So then the natto, I think it's a great, like, an incredible source of vitamin K. And what they've shown is that these women who eat in this very specific section of Japan, which I can't tell you offhand what it is, where they have this natto for breakfast every morning, have much less risk of osteoporosis because of all the vitamin K2. It's the highest source of vitamin K2, really, really high sources of it. Yeah. So, and I think also the disruption of our microbiomes is probably one of the reasons why we're also deficient in vitamin K.
Because hospitalized patients, elderly patients sometimes who take too many antibiotics sometimes develop a vitamin K deficiency because, A, they don't consume it, and, B, I believe it's something that's actually synthesized by some of the gut bacteria.
Yeah. Yes. Well, we need the good gut bacteria to synthesize it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
And the result is actually bleeding disorders, because vitamin K stands for coagulation, German word, you know, which would like, you know.
Coagulant.
Right.
With a K.
It's like, you know, when they talk about, when they want to talk about America as like a fascist country, they spell it with a K, you know, because it's the German spelling. The vitamin K is from the word coagulation, so it actually helps our blood clot if we don't have enough.
Yes, we need vitamin K to coagulate our blood. In fact, it's one of the when somebody's on a blood thinner like Coumadin or warfarin, they're told to stay away from foods rich in vitamin K.
Mm-hmm.
Like green leafy vegetables, which is vitamin K1, which is not a great source of vitamin K. It's a very short-acting. It doesn't stay in your blood system very long.
And that's a different vitamin K, the K1. It's not so much the heart-healthy vitamin K. A good vitamin K, but not per se for the heart and the bones.
Right, right. You want vitamin K2, also known as menaquinone 7. That's the one you want. It's longer acting. It stays around longer. You need much less doses of it too. So you can dose it once a day, kind of thing.
What are the studies saying in terms of the dosage? Because that keeps changing. It's in micrograms. Very, very small doses seem to suffice.
Yeah, small dose. So there was recently a study that came out where it was 100. They used 180 micrograms of vitamin K2, menaquinone 7, And they used a very specific one. It was the MenaQ7K2. And what they found is with 180 micrograms a day, every day for 3 years, that they had, it inhibited stiffening of the artery walls, and it had unprecedented statistically significant improvement in elasticity of your arteries. And they did it measuring, your carotid arteries. And then it also showed improvement in bone strength.
Wow.
And it prevented the loss, the age-related loss of bone density.
Well, that's dynamite.
So it preserved. Really, really important study. So it's 180 micrograms, but then they've also, since then, have also talked about, I think 32 micrograms is the number to sort of... that you need that minimum for preventing calcium from depositing in your arteries.
Okay.
So, so typically anywhere we're looking at, I'm dosing anywhere from 45 micrograms up to 180 micrograms a day, depending on who you're looking at and what you're treating.
And I think the standard supplements come either usually 45, but mostly 90. And I think there are a couple of brands that are 180, just one a day. So that's what you look for. So so when it comes to calcium, are you telling your women who have heart disease risk to cut back on calcium, or is there a sweet spot with calcium where you get the benefits for bone but you don't get the disadvantages vis-a-vis atherosclerosis?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to look at those numbers. I think we're wanting to prevent over-treatment. So I'm giving about 1,000 milligrams. Well, it depends also what form of calcium too. If you're looking at hydroxyapatite or something like that, which is typically what I would use for bones stuff. So if you're going to use calcium as a hydroxyapatite form, I would say I typically dose about 600 milligrams a day.
Mm-hmm.
But the important thing is you want to make sure then that you're giving it with magnesium. Mm-hmm. Really important.
Cofactors.
Vitamin D and vitamin K2.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Important cofactors for bone.
Exactly.
Okay. This is a good point at which to pause, because we've introduced the subject of going red. That's the theme this month. American Heart Association has a big campaign to increase awareness about cardiovascular disease in women. We're going to take a slightly different tack, looking at a more integrative approach to women's health with today's guest. She's Dr. Dana Cohen. And before we sign off for part one, you just want to mention you have a practice in New York City. And
I am in New York City.
And you're accepting new patients. And give us information on that.
So you can look at my website. It's www.drdanacohen.com.
Okay, very good.
Yeah.
Okay, when we return, we're going to talk more about measures women can take to protect themselves from cardiovascular disease and other women's health challenges like osteoporosis, and we're going to name names about specific supplements that may be beneficial. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.